a number of years ago, I don't know the exact date, but I can actually figure it out. You can go back to the Dafyomi cycle of Ksubos Dafhei, so it's probably something like 5 years ago. It's a Shabbos morning in Shul, and a fellow comes up to me at Ashkama, and he's holding the Gemara Ksubos. And while normally I can't do this, I know exactly, I saw the daf, I knew exactly the question he was going to ask me. I said, how is that possible? I didn't even know he was doing daf yomi, but I knew. And I knew because of a certain Gemara that takes place there. I don't think I put the Gemara in the source sheet, but I'll tell you what the Gemara says. The Gemara says that Gedolim Masei Shamayim, Gedolim Masei Tzadikim, Mi Masei Shamayim Ba'aretz. The deeds of Tzadikim are greater than God's creating the heavens and the earth. And why? So the Gemara says, because when it comes to Masei Tzadikim, and in this case they point to the Beis HaMikdash, it says that it is done with God's hands. Mikdash Hashem Konanu Yodecha. But when it comes to the creation of heavens and earth, so it's only a single hand of God. After all, it says, V'yabeshes Yadav Yatzaru. Now for those of you who are acquainted even with the most rudimentary biblical Hebrew, you know that Yadav is plural. So the Gemara says, what are you talking about? Yadav is plural. And the answer of the Gemara is Yado Ksiv, that it is written without the Yud. Now, had this taken place in the previous Dafyomi cycle, prior to this one, he would never have come up to me and asked the question. And the reason is because in the previous Dafyomi cycle, the Oz V'Hadashas did not exist. And therefore, if you wanted to check a pasuk, you had to go to the shelf and pull off a Tanakh and look it up. And maybe the Bogra HaYeshiva here are different, but at least I know when I was a student, I was usually too lazy to go pull the Tanakh off the shelf. So you just trusted the Gemara. But once they published the Oz V'Hadashas, you have to be uber lazy not to check the pasuk, because all you have to do is move your eyes to the column, and you see the pasuk is cited. And it happens to be, when you look at the pasuk cited, if you open up your Tanakh, you will see that the word Yadav in our Tanakh is written with a Yud. And I knew this question was going to be coming, because it was an obvious question if you were acquainted with the issue. And with that, I jump into sort of the first source on the sheet, which is the Gemara in Shabbos. And the Gemara in Shabbos, it's probably a more famous Gemara because it seems to be sort of the influence as to what some might term sort of the art scroll view of biblical figures. The idea that even when we have biblical figures that we usually revere, like David and Shlomo, when Tanakh seems to describe that they sinned, they really didn't sin. It happens to be it's the same Amora over and over. Omer Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani, Omer Rav Yonason, who says that Reuven didn't really sin, and at least not the way it's described, that David and Shlomo didn't. But surprisingly, most surprisingly, this is the one that shocks me, he even says that B'nai Eli didn't sin. Amar Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani Amar Rav Yonason Kala Omer B'nai Eli Chatu Eino Elatoa Shenemar Shem V'Shem Shnei B'nai Eli Chofni U'Finchas Kohanim Lashem. And he holds Savar Laka Rav that Pinchas Lo Chata. Somehow Rav held that Pinchas himself didn't actually sin, and therefore once it says Shnei B'nai Eli Makish Chofni the Pinchas Ma Pinchas Lo Chata Av Chofni Lo Chata. What it means, Rashi explains, is they didn't actually commit adultery. If you read the pasuk as described, it says Asher Yishkevun Es Hanashim Atzavos Pesach Ol Moed. So they didn't really actually do that. Actually, all they did was delay bringing their kabanos, and because these women were not able to return to their husbands, they were delayed. Therefore, it was Mala Alavakos of Ki'ilu Shechafon. Okay, so now the Gemara continues and says, for discussing this, how can you say that that Pinchas, how can you say even that both of them didn't sin? So the Gemara, and if you look to the last line, the Gemara says, Ela haksiv asher yishkevun es hanashim, and yishkevun is a plural verb. So the Gemara's answer is, yishkevun ksiv, it's written chaser vav. Then the Gemara continues to challenge based upon various verbs that are found in the Parsha that speak in the plural about the children of Eli. And the Gemara asks, V'haksiv ma'avirim am Hashem. Eli says to his children, what are the bad things I'm hearing about you? And he uses the expression, ma'avirim am Hashem. You are doing something, whatever exactly it means, to the nation of God. And again, it's in the plural. Amar Rav Huna b'rei de Rabbi Yoshua ma'avirim ksiv. It is written without the Yud. Rashi realizes immediately there's a problem. Rashi says Kosha be'enai, shem ha-chocham ha-nisker kan. And I think the Marsha points out, Rashi must have had a different girsa in the Gemara, because Rav Huna Bredi Rav Yeshua is a very well-known Amora. He was, in fact, he was the bar plugta of Rav Papa. And so Rashi seems to have had a different girsa, and he says, he doesn't know who the chacham, who the Amora who's mentioned here. Ki omar ani she-ta'us gadolhu. Rashi says there's a great error. V'lo garsina la-ha-milsa. You have to, the whole girsa of the Gemara is wrong. And why is Rashi convinced that the Girsa and the Gemara is wrong? He says, Shaharei bisvarim mugahim. Now, a sefer mugah means a sefer that has been carefully edited. And he's referring to Sifrei Tanakh. And remember, obviously, they didn't have printed svarim. They had, not scrolls probably, but codices, the parchment bound in a book. So Rashi says, in the svar mugahim, it's ksiv ma'avirim, with a yud. Vigam bimisora ha-gedola. Bimakom shemenuyim sham kol hatevos the lochsi bohen yud but v'korin in the Misora Gedola, and I'll explain in a moment, where it lists all the words that are written without a yud, but we read it as if there were a yud there. This is not counted. They don't count the word mavirim. V'heim menuyim al pi hacheshbon. They are laid out in order. They are enumerated. So Rashi goes on to say that you have to completely reread the Gemara. It means something different. And it has nothing, and it doesn't at all impinge upon the girsa that we have on in our svar. So Rashi obviously realized that the Gemara, as we have it, looks like it has a different text of Tanakh, a different spelling of a word than we have in our svarim. And Rashi concludes, at least in this case, that it must be an error in the Gemara. Now, I always like to interject a personal story here. This is obviously a very natural response. If the Gemara cites a pasuk and there's a mistake in the citation, it must be that there's a mistake in the Gemara, not chas v'shalom mistake in Tanakh. If you look in Rashi in Parshas Truma, and I haven't been by Mitzvah Parsha, and I was probably 14 or 15, the first time I was really learning on my own, and I was going through the Rashis, and if you look near the end of the first perek in Truma, the end of the first section by the Kapores. So there's a pasuk that says, "Eis kol asher atzaveus chol b'nei Yisrael." If you look in Rashi on the word "eis" says there's an extra vav here, and he quotes other examples in Tanakh where you have a superfluous vav that doesn't make sense and shouldn't be translated. Ve'ela b'nei tzivon ve'aya va'ana. That first vav doesn't really belong there. It's the first name in a list. So I looked at the Rashi and I had no clue as to what Rashi was talking about. What's going on here? What vav is he talking about? So I just never knew the answer to the question. When I was at that particular stage in my development, it never occurred to me for even a moment that perhaps Rashi had a different text in his Sefer Torah than we do. In fact, had I looked very carefully, I would have noticed that the Dibur Maschil of Rashi reads, Ve'eis kol asher atzaveus chol b'nei Yisrael. It happens to be that Vav is acknowledged by Chizkuni, it's acknowledged by Ibn Ezra. Apparently, many of the Svarim, many of the Sefer Torah in the medieval period, had a Vav there. We do not have it in our editions, of Chumash. It's not in our Masoretic text. I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit later. But sometimes you encounter these things and they exist. But at least in this particular case, Rashi says it doesn't exist. Tosus comes along and writes Ma'abirim Ksif. He says the following, Hashas Shalanu Cholek al Svarim Shalanu. Our Gemara argues on our Svarim. What are our Svarim? So our Svarim means our Sifrei Tanakh. Shekosuv bohem, and it should be ma'avirim. Our svarim have the yud. V'chein motzinu b'Yerushalmi b'shimshon. And this is really a pretty wild. V'hu shafaris Yisrael arba'im shana. If you look at the stories in Shoftim by Shimshon, at the end of Perek Tesvav, before sort of the final events of Shimshon, the Lila and pulling the house down, so it talks about Shimshon having judged the Jewish people for 20 years. It seems to be not out of place, but it's normally you only get the enumeration of the judge's years at the end of his life, at the end of the literary unit that encompasses the tales of the stories of that judge, so that's where you get the number. But you get it at the end of Perek Tesvav, and then at the end of Perek Tezayin, you get again V'hu Shafaris Yisrael Esrim Shana. That's what our Svarim have. The Yushalmi says Arba'im Shana on the second one. And what does the Yushalmi conclude from this? Malame Chahayu Plishtim Yireim Imenu Chav Shana Achar Moso Kemo B'chayav. So the Yushalmi says the following. It says that if you walk up to a Philistine, you know, and catch him from behind, you, even after Shimshon was dead, you whisper in his ear, Shimshon, he would start trembling. For 20 years after Shimshon was dead and buried, you mention him and people would just tremble over hearing about Shimshon. He's so terrified the Plishtim. So that's why he ruled over the Jewish people for 20 years alive, and then for 40 years total, for 20 years after his death, his shadow still loomed large over the Plishtim. And Tosus says, "Ubuchol Sfarim Shalanu Ksiv Chafshana." In our Sfarim, you open up your Tanakh, I'm pretty much guarantee you, both times it says Esther Mishana, which is obviously easier to deal with. There's no contradiction between the two passages. So Tosos doesn't make a big deal about it. Tosos just acknowledges the phenomenon. He says it happens. He says that there are differences between our Sfarim and what the Gemara has sometimes. And I should add a very important note of caution here. Just because the Gemara cites a pasuk in a certain manner doesn't mean the Gemara actually had the text, as you see in the printed text. Aside from the possibility that it's a manuscript error in the Gemara, it's also possible that the Gemara is citing the pasuk perhaps imprecisely. The only time you know for sure what text the Amoraim or the Tanaim had in front of them is when the Gemara makes a comment about the pasuk, where you can see what text they had in front of them. The fact that the Yushalmi prints, it says in our printed Yushalmi, "V'hu shafanis Yisrael arba'im shana," doesn't prove that it had a text that read arba'im. But from the fact that the Yushalmi juxtaposes two pesukim, it perceives a contradiction and it gives a resolution that says that Shimshon terrified the Plishtim for 20 more years after he died, shows you that the Yushalmi really had a girsa of Arba'im. If you want to see an example where this issue is very hotly debated, some of you know one of the most famous questions in the Haggadah is, what's the difference between the Chacham and the Rasha? So the Chacham says, "Maha aidos asher tziva shem lokeinu eschem," and the Rasha says, "Maha vodas os lochem." Lochem v'lo lo. So everybody says, but by the Chacham it says, Eschem. So it's the same problem. So there are many, many, many answers that have been given over the years. But many have pointed out that if you look in the Yushalmi, in the printed editions, and I believe in the one manuscript we have, the Yushalmi, the girsa and the pasuk is Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Osanu. Now, if that was the girsa that the Baal HaHaggadah had in front of him, then the drasha would make perfect sense. The reason why the Chacham is good is because he says Osanu is Lo Hotziatzmo Min HaKlal. Some have argued, though, that in fact that's not the basis, and that the girsa of the Yushalmi is incorrect. And the truth is, you can't prove anything from the printed text of the Yushalmi, because the Yushalmi there doesn't have this juxtaposition between the Chacham and the Rasha. It could simply be a printing error in the text of the Yushalmi. There's no proof there whatsoever. But in this case, the one that Tosaf cites, where you have the Drasha and the Yushalmi, makes amply clear that they had a Nusach that read Arba'in. Now, I'm going to come back to this a little bit later to talk about, well, what do we do now? Now, theologically speaking, I don't think it's a problem, but I'll talk about that a little bit. But there's a Halacha L'Maaseh Shaila, which is that if you take Shmuel, I assume that they read Haftorah here, you read from a printed book. I assume, right? Not a cloth. But if you happen to have a cloth, my shul doesn't have a cloth either, but why do you have a cloth? So the question is, what should you do now that you realize the Gemara had no Yud and a Ravi Rim, what do you do with the printed text? Or we have some examples that we'll see later that deal with Sukkim in the Torah, that the Rishonim acknowledge that we have something, Gemara had something different than we do. What do you do? Do you go back and you change our Sefer Torah, or do you leave them alone? And what are the implications for the mitzvah of writing of Sefer Torah? So I will come back to that. But I want to take a little bit of a long detour now to go back to something that Rashi commented. Rashi says, "Begam the Misora Hagadola." What is the Misora Hagadola? We always talk about the word Misora as our tradition, that which was transmitted. It's not clear what the word actually means here. But the question is, what is Rashi talking about the Misora Hagadola? So most of you probably, if you use a Chumash, Makoros Gadolos these days, probably most people use, let's say, a Torah Chaim. And if you use the Toras Chaim, you're not going to know anything about the Misora Gedola. But the Misora Gedola is actually a very important work. And it stems from a group of people that we know as the Baalei Masora. And that's what I want to talk about on this little detour. Who were the Baalei Masora? Usually, and I'll do that now a little bit, I like to come at this question from a different perspective. You take a Sefer Torah out of the Aron, you open it up, and what do you see? You see a bunch of letters and some spaces between them, and sometimes you see paragraph breaks, and that's all you see. If you were to go to visit, actually, I normally don't say this when I'm in Eretz Yisrael, in Medinat Yisrael, but now you could go to the Israel Museum, right? It's not so far from here, and go look at the shrine of the book where they have the Isaiah scroll. Okay? It's one of the oldest extant biblical texts that we have, and you look at the Isaiah scroll, and you'll see pretty much the same thing. You will see letters on a cloth. You will see spaces between words. You will see paragraph breaks. If you open up a Chumash, you see a whole lot more. I open it up, and I'm immediately, forget the English translation, okay? The Bali Masorah, we're not responsible for that. And I see dots. I see trup. I see numbers on the side, psukim. I see chapter numbers. When I scroll through it, I see a heading on top, and at the beginning of books, I see the name of a book. I see it says Yeshua, and before the Yeshua, it'll say Nevi'im. Before Torah, it says Torah. Before, and I, after I finish Treyasar, I see Ksuvim. So I see lots and lots and lots. And then also, maybe this is not a good example, but I look at a lot of Chumashim, and I see little notes in the margins, like a Krayuk Siv. The question is, where do these come from? Who is responsible for this? How is it possible, or how did our Kisvei HaKodesh go from this 2,000 years ago to looking like something like this? How did you get from one to the other? Who is responsible for that work? And the answer to the question fundamentally is the Bali Masorah. Who were the Bali Masorah? So the Bali Masorah were, there may have been more than one group of Bali Masorah, but the ones that we know about and the ones who are our authorities were some Jews who lived in Tveria. And in that region, sometime between the year 600 and 1000, I mean, I don't mean that we're not sure, it means there was a long chain of Bali Masorah of families, and they were the ones who were responsible for most of the work of making our Tanakhs look the way that they do. And I want to talk about now what is the origin of the various features that we see in Tanakh. Not everything did the Bali Masorah create. Sometimes they were only responsible for creating, you know, the symbols, but and putting them into the text, but they obviously didn't create the notion of having these features in the text. For example, the vowels. As a general rule, and I think even Welsh might not be an exception to this, you cannot pronounce a language without vowels. It's impossible. Right? You can in English, we write the vowels in. In Hebrew, and we write it as letters. In English, in Hebrew, I shouldn't say there are no vowels, but in theory, there might be no vowels. So we have vowels. We have aleph, hey, vav, and yud that often function as partially as vowel markers. But fundamentally speaking, we don't write, the Sifrei Torah do not have written vowels. But it's a certainty, beyond a certainty, that Jews used to read the Torah 2,000 years ago. And if they read the Torah, it means they read with vowels. The question is, so where did the vowels come from? Well, the answer is they always knew how to read the Torah. They had a tradition. But somebody was responsible for putting in those symbols. And those were the Bali Masorah. So they didn't invent vowels, but they did invent the system of vocalization. And in fact, I'll talk a little more about that when I get to it. So the question that I want to explore now is, where do these various features that define our Tanakh originally come from? Certainly according to our view, the traditional view. And ultimately, how did they wind up in their written form? So I sometimes phrase the question in the following fashion. If you were a golem, and all you could do was take instructions, what information would I give you, would I need to give you in order to generate our Tanakh? So the first thing you start with is obviously you need to have the letters. You need to have the letters. And when you have the letters, you need to know what the Aleph Beis is, and you need to know how those letters are written. What is the shape of the letters? So here, we believe that Moshe Rabbeinu was given the Torah at Sinai, which means he was obviously given the letters. And by the time Moshe Rabbeinu died, he had written at least one, Chazal say multiple Sifrei Torah, one for each Sheva. The only question about the letters, of course, is what did the letters look like? So generally speaking, we'd like to think, and it could be true, that they looked a lot like our letters. Does anyone know what we call our letters? What is the script? Ksav Ashuri. But if you look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin, at the end of the second parak, it's found there, it's also found in the Yerushalmi and Megillah in the first parak, you discover, most fascinatingly, that in fact there is a machlok as to what the original script of the Torah was. There is a script that we know still exists, that's used primarily by the Samaritans. You'll see it in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and some of the scrolls it's used just for the Shem Hashem. And we know it from most of the archaeological excavations or archaeological, the inscriptions that have been found from the Bayis Rishon and some from the Bayis Sheni period. We know of this script. It's called Ksav Ivri. In English we call it Paleo-Hebrew. There are three shitos in the Gemara and Sanhedrin as to what happened to the script of the Torah. The first opinion is that the Torah was originally given in Ksav Ivri, and Ezra changed it to Ksav Ashuri. The second opinion is that it was originally given in Ksav Ashuri. Kevan Shechatu, when they sinned, I think Rashi says with the Egel, it was changed to Ksav Ivri, and then when they did Tshuva, I don't know what particular time period that refers to, it was changed back to Ksav Ashuri once again. And the third opinion is that it was always in Ksav Ashuri. Okay, so I don't have any way of resolving this particular dispute. It doesn't really matter on some level. But the letters come Misinai, and the script either comes from the time of Matan Torah, or it comes from the time of Ezra. And that's how Svarim continued to be written in the Bayi Sheni period, certainly most of the Qumran scrolls that we have, and anything that we have from later, and all of our Masoretic codices are written in Ksav Ashuri. Okay, that's the first step. Then, you can talk about the Nekudos, the vowels. So as I said before, the Torah obviously always had vowels, they just weren't written, because otherwise it could not have been read. Now we happen to know of one system of vocalization, which is our vowels. We call it Nikud Tiveriani, Tiberian vocalization, because it came from the Baalei Masorah in Tiberia. There are actually two other systems of vocalization. One of them, as far as I know, is only known from the Cairo Geniza. They call it Ksav Nikud Eretz Yisrael, Palestinian vocalization. It's very, very rare. The other kind was actually much more common, but I don't know if there's anybody here of Taimani extraction, but if you show it to older Taimanim, I'm sure they would be able to read it very comfortably, maybe even more so than they can read Nikud Tveriani. And then we call it Babylonian vocalization. The Nekudos there are all written on top of the letters. The symbols are mostly different than our symbols. Two of them overlap. And they're dots and lines, and a couple of them are not exactly like that. And the only other distinguishing feature of the Babylonian vocalization that the Yemenites used until a generation or two ago is that the Ksegel and the Patach are one and the same vowel. There is no distinction. Other than that, it more or less sort of conforms to the vocalization system of Tveria, except for it's a different set of symbols. So if we talk about the Nekudos, so there are multiple systems, but we use the Tiberian Tiberian vocalization. Okay, what else is there? So, talk about trop. Where does trop come from? Does anyone know what the earliest mention of trop would be? It's the Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara in Megillah mentions something called Piskei Ta'amim, which might be a reference to trop. Trop, as you know, has multiple functions. The two primary functions of trop are, number one, the secondary function is to provide music, and the first and primary function of trop is to what? Anybody know? Punctuation. I know it also tells you where the tom is, where the accent is, but it's primarily about punctuation. And it's a very developed system of how you punctuate, how you break down a sentence into larger units and then smaller units. It's clear from the Gemara that there was some type of punctuation. It's also clear that it was not as crystallized or as solidified as the way we have it now. There's a famous Gemara in Yoma that Chamesh Mikraos Ein Lahem Hechreya. They have no definitive resolution. In other words, we don't know where to put the commas. For example, in Parshas Truma, it says, Uvam Menorah Arba'ah Givim Meshukadim Kaftarel Frachecha. So the way our Masoretic text reads, it's Uvam Nora Arba Gevi'im, Kama, and Meshukadim Kaftor El Fracha. The Kaftorim and the Frachim on the menorah were Meshukadim. They were decorated somehow, whatever that word means. However, the Gemara entertains the possibility that maybe it should be read, Uvam Nora Arba Gevi'im Meshukadim. And in addition, there were Kaftorim and Frachim in the main branch of the menorah. So the Gemara clearly has certain questions, unresolved issues of punctuation. If they had as clear a system of trop as we do, if they had the esnachtas that we do, they probably wouldn't have had the question. So undoubtedly, they had some trop, but it's not clear how crystallized it was. But eventually, it was crystallized by the Baalei Masorah. They are the ones who are responsible for giving us the trop that we have, more or less. I say more or less because the trop has evolved somewhat. I assume some of you are Baalei Kriya here. So you know the most annoying thing about a Tlisha Gedolim and Tlisha Katana is what? Yeah?
Whether it goes up or down? Is the sound
of it? Oh, that is true too. It's nasty teaching Bar Mitzvah kids, teaching them the difference. But forget that for the moment. You know how to read the music. What's the most annoying thing about those trups, among a few other trups? Where to put the accent. Right? Most print things do not, you know, some of the modern print things will use the doubling system, you know, where you put two when it's mila el and leave one when it's mila ra. But most print things, the plisha gadola is always printed before the word, and the plisha katana is always printed after the word. Does anyone want to know why? Well, if you look back at the Masoretic codices that we have, you'll see that the symbol for the two plishas was originally identical. It's just a circle. And the only way to distinguish it was putting one before the word and one after the word. Only later did the shapes develop where somebody decided to stick a little leg on and they made it pointed. At that point, it wouldn't have been necessary, but the convention and the nomenclature of putting the Tlisha Gedola before the word and the Tlisha Ketana after the word remained in place. So, more or less, if you look at the Masoretic codices, more on that in a moment, that we have, you will see that their trop looks, most cases look pretty much like our trop. Now, I'll take a step aside for a moment to talk about, I now mentioned many times, the Bali Masar and the Masoretic codices. What is a codex? That's the first question. So, the codex was a very important invention. I'll term it an invention. A codex is a book. Now, I know it doesn't seem like an invention to you because you take books for granted. But really, a codex was a parchment bound in by a margin rather than a scroll. Why is a codex so wonderful? What's so great about a codex? Yeah? Random access, in computer terminology. You can basically go anywhere you want in the book in an instant. I'm sure many of you have had the experience being in shul where the gabbai had failed to do his job, and everybody's waiting while it takes 10 minutes to roll from mezuzah, bracha, to brachos, or the like. Right? That doesn't happen with a codex, because you just turn the pages. Now, a codex is not kosher to read from in a tzibur, but nonetheless, if you're talking about learning purposes and scholarly purposes, it's an incredibly useful invention. You wonder why nobody thought of it before. I think it was an invention that came out of the Islamic world and in that period, and the Bali Masorah adopted this for doing their work, because it's a much more efficient system. If you look at Masoretic codices, some of them have been printed actually in facsimile editions. Typically speaking, they're written on a page in three columns, and they have already vocalization, and they have trup, and then they have a lot of notations in the margin and some notations on the bottom. There are still some old chumashim. If you look at the old chumashim, it really starts, one of them is the Vienna printing of 1859 and a lot of the photo offsets of that particular printing, and certainly the printings of Chumash, the printed text that preceded that, often have some of these notes. They don't typically have three columns, but they have notes in the margin. And these notes are Masoretic notes. The notes that are found in the margin, which are very short, is known as, that apparatus is known as the Masorah Ketana. And the more extended version of the notes at the bottom is called the Masorah Gedola. Now, what is the purpose of all this? So, firstly, if you want to have some good Shabbos things to tell at the Shabbos table, and you want to just bother people, so you can just walk in and say, well, how many times is the word he in the Torah written with a yud? Because normally he in the Torah is written with a vav. So if somebody doesn't have a computer in front of them, so you could just annoy them and ask them all sorts of questions like this. Now, I'm not sure why you would want to do that. It might be better than some of the other things that are spoken about at the Shabbos table, but nonetheless, if you're interested in making, you know, having a little fun, of course, there's only one little problem. You know, at some point they're going to say to you, well, I don't know, and they'll tell you, what's the answer? And your response is, well, I don't know either, but it was a good question. But if you know about the Masorah Ketana, you can look in the margin, and most of the Masoretic notes that are found in that little margin tell you about a particular word and its spelling and how many other times it's found in Tanakh. Now, a word like S that's probably found thousands of times, there's no Masoretic note. But if you have a word like he, which is only found in our Sifrei Torah, supposed to be at least, 11 times in the Torah written with a yun, you will get a note in the margin that says one of 11. If you have a word that's very rare in Tanakh, it occurs twice, you'll see a little beis in the margin. If a word only occurs spelled malay, let's say with the extra vav or the extra yud, it will say beis malay. A lot of, by the way, the Baal HaTurim, some of you may know of the commentary, the Baal HaTurim, a travesty was perpetrated against the Baal HaTurim. Apparently the commentary is a grape shot commentary, and it's much longer, but somebody decided in printing it just to abbreviate and give you all the Vertelach, not the real commentary. So everybody knows the Baal HaTurim has all these gematrias and things like that, and a lot of it is based upon these Masoretic notes. How did he know that words were so uncommon? He didn't spend his time, I mean, he could have, but he didn't spend his time counting the words. He just looked at the Masoretic notes, and he knew exactly when a word was very rare, and how many times it occurred, and where it occurred. So that is what the Mesorah Gedolah, Mesorah Ketana is the short version, and Mesorah Gedolah often expands and gives you a word or two. Assuming you know Tanakh, it will tell you where the other occurrences are. Now, you might ask yourself a question, aside from the person who asks these seemingly silly questions at the Shabbos table, why would people have spent their lives doing this? Right. I mean, look, again, it's better than a lot of other pursuits of Batala, but this seems going a little bit overboard. Why would anybody have taken and dedicated their lives to generating these notes, to checking these notes, and so on and so forth? So the answer to the question, in fact, I should take a step back. When does this activity begin? Our Masoretic codices come from the Bali Masorah of Tveria in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries. But when did people start doing this? When did this seemingly mind-numbing pursuit begin? And the answer is, it's already recorded in the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin, in a somewhat famous passage, says, Lama nikru harishonim sofrim, like Ezra ha-sofer, shahayu sofrim kol osio shebetorah. They counted all the letters in the Torah, they could tell you which was the middle letter. The Vav of Gachon is supposed to be the middle letter, it's not, but it's supposed to be according to the Gemara. They tell you which is the middle pasuk, and so on. They can tell you how many psukim are in the Gemara, in Chumash, how many psukim are in Tehillim, and so on and so forth. The Gemara, I think, is daf lamed aleph, amed aleph, in Kiddushin. So this idea of counting letters is obviously, goes back a very long way. So, but why would anybody do it? So the answer to the question, anybody have an idea? Why? Yes.
Accuracy of transmission.
Correct. Now, the answer was accuracy of transmission. Now, you say that's a funny way of doing things. It's not a funny way of doing things. If any of you know computers a little bit and sort of nuts and bolts, there's something called a parity check. It was a bigger deal once upon a time in the first days before almost any, except for the Rabbeim, before any of you were born amongst the students. In the first days of computers, the PC, if a parity error came up on the screen, you knew you were in a lot of trouble because your computer froze and you lost all your work. Parity, this is basically a kind of parity check. And what does it mean? Well, look, how do you transmit a Sefer Torah accurately? Well, you copy it really, really carefully. And then you know, in case, what if you made a mistake? You check it over. But some of you may know, like if you write papers, at a certain point you read it once or twice, and you can't read it again. And if you made a typo, you're not going to catch it. And the same thing can happen with Sofrim or copying Svarim. So what the Bali Masorah refined and advanced, but something that had existed already, was a backup mechanism for verifying the accurate transmission of the text. You're not going to know that you got every he by he, looking at one text against the other. Instead, you want to know whether this text is correct. Well, you know that there are supposed to be 11 he's in the Torah with a yud in it. So basically, you go back to your Sefer Torah and you count. You're no longer comparing one text against another. You're using a completely different mechanism. And the odds of, now, errors can still happen. Guess what? If you wrote to the word he wrong twice, and one time you took a yud and you turned into a vav, and one time you took a vav and you turned it into a yud, you're not going to catch the error. It's true, but the odds of making an error are dramatically reduced from just checking over the same text over and over. And that's what the idea, that's the notion that develops from Ezra and through the period of the Amoraim and what the Baalei Masorah perfected. So that's why they developed all these notes. Now, once they've done that great work for us, you can have a lot of fun with it in a serious way and even in a humorous way. So that was the magnum opus of the Baalei Masorah. It was this work of counting the words and checking the words and counting the letters and checking all the spellings. And amazingly enough, the work of the Baalei Masorah, it's almost a miracle, because if you know the history of the dispersion of Torah Shebaal Peh and rabbinic authority, you know that until at least the year 1000, rabbinic authority was centered in Babel. There were a lot of conflicts between Eretz Yisrael and Babel, the great calendar controversy of the early 10th century. There was always a source of tension. And by the time the Baalei Masorah had finished their work, they were working in Eretz Yisrael, which was a backwater, comparatively speaking. And Jews already had dispersed to Europe, to Tehman, they were all over the place. And nonetheless, amazingly enough, the work of the Baalei Masorah was accepted b'chol tfutzos Yisrael. You take out an Ashkenazi Sefer Torah, you take out a Sephardi Sefer Torah, you take out a Taimani Sefer Torah, a good version of each one, a well-checked Sefer Torah, and the number of differences in terms of any spellings of words, you know, Male and Kasser and everything else, difference in Parsha breaks, I believe can be enumerated probably on one hand. There are a few famous ones. Ptsua Daka, amongst Ashkenazim Sifrei Torah and Sephardi Sifrei Torah, one has a hey, one has an aleph. There's one parsha break in all of Chumash that the Taimanim have different than Ashkenazim and Sephardim. You'll see it in Reb Breuer's Chumash; he has it marked. But the fact that the work of the Balei Masorah disseminated so broadly was so broadly accepted, and that basically Sifrei Torah from Kol Tfutzos Yisrael are in agreement in 99.999% of the time. It's like a nes nisa. It's amazing. Because if you think about any other practice in the Jewish community, what is so broadly accepted and with such unity in Klal Yisrael? Okay. There are a few other things that I will just want to briefly touch upon about the Balei Masorah before I start to come back to our original discussion. Parsha breaks, the psuchos and stumos that are found in the Sefer Torah. So those psuchos and stumos clearly exist from a very, very ancient period. We see them in the Qumran scrolls, which are our earliest Hebrew biblical existing scrolls. Chazal attribute them to Har Sinai. And we have no evidence, no reason to think otherwise. The only issue with the Parsha breaks is that there was a long time where there were a lot of differences between Sfarim. And here there's a famous passage in the Rambam in Hilchos Sefer Torah Tfilah Mezuzah. I think it's in Perek Ches, where the Rambam, if you actually look in the, I think it's the 8th Perek, the Rambam lists you every single Parsha, Psucha and Stuma, in the Torah. But he says the reason that he did it is that he looked at the different Sefer Torah, and he saw that there were so many differences, so he recorded them based upon a manuscript he had in Cairo, which was edited by Ben Asher, who is among probably the most famous and considered authoritative of the Balei Masorah, Aaron Ben Asher. He was the last one in a long chain in a family of the Ben Asher family. And the Rambam used that scroll as his guide, and he lists the Parsha breaks. Do any of you know what that scroll is otherwise known as today? That is the Aleppo Codex. There was some controversy when it originally came out. Professor Kasuto, based upon errors in the print, that Rambam assumed it wasn't, but that is assumed to be what then eventually made its way to Syria and is known as the Aleppo Codex. The letters were not written by Aaron ben Asher, but everything else, the vowels, the trup, the Masoretic notes, were done by Aaron ben Asher. I forget who the scribe was for the letters. We know, but basically, that's where the Rambam took his Parsha breaks from. What else is there? Psukim divisions. So the Gemara seems to have a conflict over this issue. You probably know of a very well often quoted Gemara found in Megillah and Tanis that kol psuke de lo paske Moshe Rabbeinu anano paskina. If Moshe Rabbeinu didn't break the pasuk in a certain place, we can't break the pasuk in half. That's why on Rosh Chodesh, you know, there are two opinions what you do when you have to get three aliyos in the first 10 psukim of Parshas in Perech of Ches and Parshas Pinchas, you know there's a problem. The problem is that you have 8 psukim and a Parsha break, and then 2 psukim of Shabbos. And how do you get 2 aliyos out of that first section? And what we do is we read 3 psukim, and then we repeat 1 pasuk and read the next 2, and then we continue on. That's what we do in Rosh Chodesh. But there's another opinion in the Gemara that what you do is you read 2.5 psukim. You make up your own pasuk. And the objection to that is that we don't break the pasuk when Moshe Rabbeinu didn't break the pasuk. However, there is the same Gemara in Kiddushin I referred to earlier seems to take a very different opinion on this. The Gemara in Kiddushin says that in Eretz Yisrael they used to take a particular pasuk in Parshas Yisro and they used to break it up into 3 psukim. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Hinei Anochi Ba'alecha Ba'at Ha'anan, and so on and so forth. So it's not entirely clear whether Chazal were in agreement whether the psukim breaks really go back to Sinai or they come from later. Interestingly enough, there is actually a piece of evidence that tells us that the psukim break are much earlier than Chazal. And that piece of evidence is the fact that in the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Samaritans broke off, it's not entirely clear, but they certainly had already broken off from the rest of Klal Yisrael by the year 300. So the Samaritans have virtually the identical psukim breaks in their Torah that we have. It's virtually identical, which means the psukim breaks already had to have been solidified broadly and established no later than the year 300 BCE. Again, they certainly could go back to Sinai, but we don't have any, obviously, original evidence. Sedra breaks. Okay, I know today we call it the Parsha. Parshas HaShavuah, but it should probably be called Sidras HaShavuah. Okay, the Parsha breaks refer to the Psuchos and Stumos. The Sedra refers to what we call the Parsha. Where do the Sedra breaks come from? So we don't really know. What we do know is that some of our Sedra breaks as we have it already are mentioned by the Gemara and Megillah. We don't know if all of the Sedra breaks are identical. And we also know, by the way, in Eretz Yisrael, they had very different system of Sedra breaks. Because in Eretz Yisrael, how long did it take them to finish reading the Torah?
3 years.
Technically not correct. 3.5 years. They used to have Simchas Torah alternatively on Pesach and Sukkot, depending on which year in the cycle. We know that from the Piyutim and the Geniza, but it's close enough. It means they had different Parsha breaks, because otherwise you can't get by 54, you have 154 weeks or something like that, you need more than 54 Sedras. So we don't know exactly when all of our Sedras in the Babylonian cycle, the annual cycle reading the Torah, originate from. Some are already mentioned in the Gemara. By the time the Rambam, I think, lists them, they're identical to our Sedra breaks. Okay. What else is there? There are chapter numbers, chapter breaks. And chapter breaks are interesting in their own right, because the chapter breaks, and don't say this too loud, otherwise we might in a few years start having problems with our printed Sfarim, the chapter breaks are actually a non-Jewish invention. The chapter breaks were invented and done by, it's not clear who did it. It may have been one of the archbishops of Canterbury, I think, in the 13th century, or it may have been a French clerical figure around the same time. They basically needed a system of referring to psukim. And as you can imagine, there are probably something like, I don't know, 1,500-something psukim and breishis. If they're not numbered, and even if they are numbered, you don't want to number 1 to 1,500. So they basically introduced chapter breaks. Most of the time, they introduced them in reasonable places. Sometimes they introduced them in silly places. When you typically see, when you get to the end of Sedras, occasionally you'll see the first pasuk of the next parak. And it's not just that we break this. It's not that we're breaking the Sedra in a strange place. It's that the people who put the chapter breaks in, you know, it's not clear what they were thinking when they did that. But the chapter breaks fundamentally are a non-Jewish invention. But basically, it has been accepted, you know, in pretty much all of Klal Yisrael, we use the chapter breaks. And obviously, the psukim number is just, you just count within a parak. That's not a, there's no chiddush there. The last question, and I don't know the answer to this question, and none of the people in the world of scholarship I've asked this question to have the answer, is where do our aliyah breaks come from? Now here's a good piece of trivia, and I could be wrong, I could not know all of them. There are two places in our printed Chumashim where there's a difference as to where you break an aliyah. Does anybody know where they are? What's that? Somebody said it? Yeah. One is in Parshas Bereishis about how do you read Oz Huchal Lekro B'Shem Hashem. It's the end of Perek Dalid. Do you break it there, or do you break it a few psukim earlier? That depends on whether or not B'Shem Hashem is Avodah Zarah or Hashem, whether it's a bad place to end or not. That's one. And the other one? Statistically, there's got to be somebody with that bar mitzvah parsha in the room who likely would know it because somebody corrected it. So that would be me, Parshas Truma. Whether you break at the end of Perech Hafei, right after the menorah, or you break between the Shulchan and the menorah. As far as I know, those are the only two places I've encountered a difference in aliyos. Aliyos have been standardized, but as you well know from Hosafos, there's no reason it has to be that way. Yeah? Is there another one?
Syrians have some different aliyot breaks.
Okay, so, oh, so fine.
Not most of them, but a few of them are different.
So the question, so as you know, halakhically speaking, you could, there are rules where you can and can't break. Right? You can't break within three psukim before at the end of a parsha psucha or stuma, unless you're in a parsha psucha or stuma. But other than that, you know, and you don't break in the middle of the tochacha in Vayikra al pidina de gemara, and one machmor where you don't break in the middle of the tochacha in Kisavo. But more or less, there's a great degree of flexibility. We make Hosafos when we have to. It's not a big deal. I don't know where, but our aliyos have become virtually standardized, right? You're telling me that even among Syrians, it's almost identical. You can look, Hebrew U, or the Jewish National University Library, has online something called the Digitized Book Repository. And they have they've taken a lot of printed books, and they've scanned them, and you can actually go look at them, and you can look at printed Chumashim from the first Rabbinic Bible, the second Rabbinic Bible, and you can see where the aliyah breaks start to emerge. I don't remember the data, but I did find one somewhere probably 18th century or something like that, where you start to see, the first time I was able to find aliyah breaks, some of which are hourly briefs, and some of which are not at all. So I don't know who standardized them, when they became standardized. I know they are almost standardized. So if you ever find the answer to that question, I would appreciate if you pass it on. The people I've asked in the world of scholarship, nobody seems to know exactly when the aliyah breaks come from. Okay. So I think that's more or less, I think I've given you enough. I've been bored you to death about the Bali Masorah. I'll add one last detail, the Krayuk Siv also. The Krayuk Siv that we know of is a Masoretic note. Just as you can have a note in the margin that says Aleph, you don't have Aleph, Beis. You know, this word occurs twice, okay? Or the word appears four times, or it appears six times with a Vav. You also, among the Masoretic notes, are what we call Krayuk Siv, that tells us how to read a word. And what typically speaking is the word is written one way in the text, and on the side it says, and usually the Bali Masorah and many of the codices put in the vowels of the Kray, and in the margins it says, Kuf, with a little strich, Kray, read it in the following fashion. The Kray Uksiv is a Masoretic note. I'm not going to talk about now what is the origin of Kray Uksiv. That's a separate discussion. Okay, so now we know we have a little bit of a flavor of who the Bali Masorah are and how our texts came to be. So our printed texts we know are in fact the work of the Bali Masorah. Now we have a problem. What happens when the Gemara reads one way? The Gemara clearly had a different text than we do. What do we do? Now, I don't want to talk very much about the theological question, but I do feel at least it's important to address it for a moment. There was a tremendous Talmud Chacham and scholar, a gadol in the previous century, Reb Chaim Heller. I believe that the Rav only gave, or at least published certainly, a very small number of Hespedim, and one of them was for Reb Chaim Heller. Reb Chaim Heller, who was familiar with the world of scholarship, he did his work, his scholarly work, on the Syriac Aramaic translation of the Torah, the Peshitta. So he was well aware of this particular problem, but he, through creative interpretation, attempted to do away with all of these potential textual variants. It's not only in Gemaras that you find this. You find this a lot when you study Targum. If you study the Jewish Aramaic Targumim, most of you know Unklus, but there are other Aramaic Targumim of Jewish origin. It looks a lot like the Meturgaman who translated had a slightly different text in front of him than we do. And that's a very complicated discussion because sometimes a translator is allowed to and needs to take some liberties with the text he's translating for various reasons. But even when you do away with all the various explanations that can explain why, it's not that the translator had different text in front of him. There are still a lot of cases where it looks like the Meturgamanim, even Unklus, had a slightly different text in front of him than we have in the Masoretic text. The Reb Chaim Heller denied the existence of textual variants within Chazal. Interestingly enough, some people were upset at the publication, but I believe that Mark Shapiro published the unpublished letters of the Sri Deish, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was another one of the Gedolim of that era, who was very well acquainted, maybe more acquainted with the world of academic Jewish scholarship, and he was a little disparaging with Chaim Heller's attitude. The Sri Deish thought it was simply inconceivable in light of all the data to claim that textual variants didn't exist. I would just come at it from a different angle. Most of the Rishonim and the Achronim knew they existed, and they didn't get bent out of shape. If you open up the Gemara on Shabbos Nun Hamad Beis here, you will see what I believe, I don't know for sure, might be the longest Gilyon HaShas in Shas. Rabbi Akiva Eger's notes on the margin. You know, normally Rabbi Akiva Eger's comments are like, you know, six words if you're lucky. Right? Here, he goes down and starts collecting examples. The note is on the Balei HaTosfos who said, Hashash Shalanu Cholek al Svarim Shalanu, that we have a different text in our Gemara than our Svarim. The little note that Reb Kiver uses is there, and on the side he counts example after example after example, and it's not comprehensive, by the way, because the example I started with, B'Abeshes Yodav Yotzaru, is not in that list. But there are many, Kahena V'Kahena, there are many of them. The Rishonim and the Achronim were not really bothered by the question. In fact, we're going to come to in a moment, the Rashba was asked the very halachic question that I've raised, which is, what do you do when the Gemara has one thing, and our Svarim, our Sifrei Torah, our Sifrei Tanakh, have something else? What should you actually write? Now, the reason why I suspect Reb Chaim Heller, I mean, there's probably more to it than this, wanted to deny the existence of textual variants is because he was bothered by concerns over the Rambam's Eighth Ikar, and what does it say that we don't have the exact text of Moshe Rabbeinu? Now, as I said, most of the Rishonim weren't bothered by the question. If you look at the certain reschos of the Rambam's Eighth Ikar, the Rambam doesn't even say what you think he says. I'm not going to explore that now. But suffice it to say that I think most Rishonim would argue that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the Torah, he gave it to human beings, and he knew that human beings had to transmit it. And therefore, human beings are not perfect, and errors are going to occur in transmission. What happens when you have a machlokas? What did Chazal do? Not that only did the Rishonim know the textual variants, Chazal knew it. And I want to read one passage with you here. if you go to Roman numeral 5, it's on one of the last psukim in the Torah. Me'ono Elohei Kedem. Shlosha Sfarim Nimsu Ba'azara. Echad Shel Me'onim. V'Echad Shel Hihi. V'Echad Nikra Sefer Zatutim. Now today, I know in my shul, when you want to refer to Sefer Torah, it usually goes by the donor's name. It's the Goldberg Sefer Torah. But here, apparently, they had a Sefer Torah that was named Hihi. And then a Sefer Torah that was named Zatutim. And then a Sefer Torah that was named Me'ona. How did these Sfarim get their names? So the Sifrei explains. Sifrei, by the way, is the Medrash Halacha, which is a Tanaitic Medrash on Sefer Dvarim. The Sifrei says, Be'echad ksiv ma'on Elohei Kedem, uveshnayim ksiv ma'ona Elohei Kedem. These were three probably official Sifrei Torah. They were in the Azara. Two of them read ma'ona, like we have. One of them said, Ma'on. What did they do? Bitlu chachamim es ha'echad v'kiyimu hashnayim. They did what we always do in halacha. The rule is, achrei rabim lahatos, that you always follow a rov. And so that's what they did. They established the correct text that you're supposed to write is ma'ona. And the same thing happened with hihi. There were two of them had the word hi with the yud 11 times. One of them had it with 9 times with the yud. And they decided to make, they followed the 11. And the same thing with a couple of other words. I'm not going to, the details you can read. Now, I always like to point out from a statistical perspective, if this is all you knew, what is the probability that our Sefer Torah is identical to that of Moshe Rabbeinu's? And the answer is 8 to 27. That's the statistical probability. If you only had one suffix, it'd be a 2/3 probability, if you only had the Mona. If you have two sfeikos, now when you are machria, when you decide and take the majority of both, you're now dealing with a 4/9 possibility. And if you have three, it's now 8/27. And as you can imagine, as the textual variants mount, the probability becomes infinitesimally small. I don't think this problem bothered the Rishonim for a very simple reason, because lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasharis. What we were given, the Torah, was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Our job is to transmit it. When we have a suffix, our job, halacha says, achrei rabim lahatos. The only correct Sefer Torah, al-Pidin, that was supposed to have been written in the time of Chazal, read Me'ona, it had Hihi 11 times, and it had whatever other two words. That is the correct Sefer Torah. We're not interested in the historical question, is that exactly Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer? It's irrelevant. That's not what the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah is. That probably is how the Rishonim would have dealt with the theological question. But the practical question certainly does matter. And the examples we've cited until now, the ones we've looked at with our own eyes, forget the Sifrei, have all been from Tanakh. But if you look at a famous example, if you learn Sanhedrin, you can't avoid this. So on the source base, the Gemara records a machlokas beis Shammai and beis Hillel as to what is the minimum number of sprinklings of blood of a karban chatas that must go on the mizbeach to be yotzei. Lechatchila, you need 4. B'di'eved, beis Hillel says 1, beis Shammai says 2. The Gemara explains the machlokas is based upon the words karnos, 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 found at the end of Perek Dalet and Sefer Vayikra by the Chatas Hayochid of Kisva, Chatas Hayochid of Seira, and the Chatas Hanasi. By those three things, you have the word karnos hamizbeach, and the Gemara, you read the Gemara carefully, and the Ran emphasizes this point, the Chidush Ran in Source Gimel. The Gemara clearly had twice the word written karnas without a vav, and once with a vav. Open our own takeout of Sefer Torah. The yeshiva should still be here. It might already be Chodesh Nisan, so you might not be here. But when they read Vayakel Pekudei, okay, I think it's part of the Chodesh this year. So just scan ahead a little bit. Just roll the Sefer Torah ahead a little bit before you go away. You know, for the break for Pesach, and check your Sefer. I guarantee you the following: In all three occurrences, it's going to say karnas. We read it karnos all the time, no question. It's written chaser vav. The Ran points this out. He just says, it's mashma mafurash from the Gemara, that one of the words in the Sefer Torah has to be a vav. You can't tell from the Gemara, by the way, which one it is, for sure. Rashi tells you which one it is. But certainly you know one of them is. And yet, the Ran says, our Sefer Torah only have karnas. And then he goes on to point to a couple of famous examples that you will encounter if you learn Rashi and Chumash. If you do Shnai Mikra with Rashi, you will encounter those examples. One of them you did already maybe a month and a half ago. V'levnei ha-pilag shim asher li Avraham. Rashi quotes a medrash, probably Bereishis Rabbah. Pilag shim is written chaser yud before the last mem. And Rashi says, malame, that it's only one pilagish. That Keturah was also known as Hagar, because it was only one pilagish, because it's chaser ksiv. You will see, come Parshas Noso, Vayihi b'yom kalos Moshe l'kimis ha-mishkan, Rashi says that it's written, it's a Bamidbar Rabbah, he's quoting, Rashi says it's written kalas, to teach you that the day the Mishkan was established, Klal Yisrael was like a kala to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it was like a Yom Chuppah. Now, the Ran cites both of these examples, where both of those midrashim have a different text than our Sefer Torah. It exists. It's not a theological problem, but it exists. Now, when you get to source 4, the Tekuva Hilchatit, what is the response? The Rashba was asked the question, and here you're going to encounter the irony of ironies. The Rashba was asked the question, what do you do in these cases? Now, I'm going to tell you what the Rashba's answer was. You're not going to see it there. If you try to read the text, it's not going to read straight. The Rashba said that if the drasha of the Gemara is a halachic drasha, you change our Sefrei Torah to match that which the Gemara had. If it's only an Agadah, then you don't change it. He doesn't explain why. He just acknowledges that there are lots of these shinuyim. Not only in the Gemaras, he talks about Madin Chai and Maravai, which is not clear what they were, two different schools of Balei Masora. He says there are a lot of them, but that's the rule he gives you. Halacha versus Agadah. Now the irony of ironies is that the text of the Tshuva of the Rashba became corrupted. Of all places to happen, and the Mincha Shai, some of you Balei Kriya may know the Mincha Shai is, Rav Yedidya Norzi, who was an Italian Rav, I think 17th century, he wrote a commentary on Chumash and parts of Nevi'im and Ksuvim as well. Non-Chumashim today don't print it, but in some certain Chumashim it's printed like after each Sefer, where he goes through a lot of the major Masoretic issues. So Balei Kriya should use it to checking about certain kinds of trucks and certain vocalizations, but he's also interested in Masoretic issues, spellings, right, which don't really interest Balei Kriya, because you read, you know what to read. And most Balei Kriya are not going to know, if it's a Malei V'chaser, you're not going to realize there's a mistake in the Sefer Torah, because most of us, self-included, don't know the Malei V'chaserim. Now, the Mincha Shai, in a few places, raises this issue. I think he raises it on Karnos, he raises it on Totafos, and he quotes a tshuva of the Rashba, or tshuva of the Rambam, which is really the Rashba, which says that you don't change our Sfarim. You ignore the Gemara. The text that Mincha Shai had in front of him was corrupted. If you read our text of the tshuva of the Rashba, you'll see it doesn't read straight. So how do I know? How do we know what the Rashba really said? The answer is because other Rishonim cited him. The Me'iri in the Kiryas Sefer, his work on Sefer Torah, Tefillah, Mezuzah, cites not by name, but it's clear you can see the words cited from the Tshuva, and other Rishonim as well cite this Tshuva, the Rashba, and they cite it in a coherent form. It reads straight, and what the Rashba says is, if it's a halachic issue, change the text. If it's a non-halachic issue, if it's an agadic issue, don't change the text. Now, what happened, halacha l'maisa, ironically, Professor Schneer Lyman has an article about this, he often speaks about this, is that the halacha manual that Sofrim generally use today, and was used for a long time certainly, is the Kesis HaSofer by Rav Gansfried. I think he's also the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And in the Kesis HaSofer, the first edition that he published had a haskama from the Chasam Sofer, where the Chasam Sofer said that everything in this book is halacha l'maisa. And then the Chasam Sofer died. In the first edition, the Kesis HaSofer didn't talk about this issue. What do you do when you have a Sefer Torah, when the Chazal had a different text than we do? In the second edition, which was published after the Chasam Sofer's death, and I don't know what the Chasam Sofer would have said, so he quotes the Mincha Shai, and that's how the Kesis HaSofer paskens. That we follow the Mincha Shai here, that follow the Rashba, that you never change our Sefer Torah. Now that also came with printed with the Haskam of the Chasam Sofer, even though the Chasam Sofer might have agreed or disagreed. Be that as it may, it has become the established practice of Sofrim today, is that they will not, they follow their own Sfarim, and they will not change anything to match the Gemara. In fact, I often tell the story, to me it's very clear, some would dispute this, but there's some of you know that when we read Megillas Esther, many have the minhag to read a certain pasuk, two pasukim, repeat a word, repeat a phrase, repeat a pasuk, lifteim, bifteim, larog, vilarog. So it's clear to me, and people have written about this, that we know what the correct nusach is. We have it in the Aleppo Codex and its entire family. We actually don't have Aleppo there, but we know what it has. We know what the closest manuscripts to Aleppo have, that is Villarog and I think Lifnehem. And you can tell, by the way, from the Masoretic notes, not just from the text itself. And it's clear to me, if you ask me how to write a Megillah, that's the way you write it. Most Megillahs today are not written that way. They're written wrong. Okay, you want to read a book, it doesn't possible a Megillah. A Megillah is not like a Sefer Torah. As long as most of it's there, you're fine. So I remember I had a kid who I taught for Bar Mitzvah, and I taught him in addition to his Parsha, he read Megillas Esther. And says, parents, as a Bar Mitzvah present, bought him a Megillah. So he brings me the Megillah, and the first thing, I had a Megillah also already at the time, and my Megillah was also written wrong, I hadn't done anything about it. But he brings me the Megillah, and I say, okay, this is not good. Bring it back to the Sofer, ask him to change it. Sofer refused to do it. Refused to do it. Years later, I took it to one of the Sofrim in the Heights, who's really he's a Malach Hashem, not because of this, that's just who he is, Rabbi Lazdun, and probably because of my position, I asked him to change it. He didn't ask questions, he changed it for me, and my Megillah at least. But Sofrim, generally speaking, adhere to their traditions, and they don't want to change things. It's good and it's bad, but that's the reality. In fact, one of the things that Professor Lyman entertains the question of why, if he points out that the Rashba said what he said, that you're supposed to change the Sfarim, and Rishon Min Achronim, Dor Achar Dor, give the same response, and yet the scribes never listen to them. Why not? So he has this theory that just as the Christians had scribal guilds, the scribes, the Sofrim amongst the Jews, sort of functioned the same way. They were sort of a closed group, and they didn't take too many instructions from people. Okay. Anyway, that's speculation. We don't know for sure. But the bottom line is, the Lamaisa practice today is that we don't change in cases where the Masoretic text clearly has one thing, and the Gemara has something else. We don't depart from the Masoretic text. We write what we have in the Masoretic text. One postscript to this, and then I'm happy to take questions, is a fascinating comment of the Shagas Aryeh, which addresses sort of the larger issue of textual variance. How many of you have written Fulfill the Mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah? Are you going to tell me you wrote one letter? Come on. Let's be real about this. How many families have a Sefer Torah in your house? Or maybe a Sefer Torah, but you put it in the shul. How many have a Sefer Torah? I don't. Okay, I say, Rabbi Konya, we have one. So the question is, why not? So the answer, the real answer is probably economics. But the Shagas Aryeh was bothered by the question, and he wanted to be Malamed Tzkos on Klal Yisrael. So Shagas Aryeh says the following. He says, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah, well, let me take one step back. What do you do when you don't have a kosher Sefer Torah, you only have a pasul Sefer Torah? So most of the Rishonim, it sounds like, would assume that you don't make brachos. The Ramah quotes a tshuva of the Rambam, which the Rambam says, you can make a bracha on a pasul Sefer Torah. Not only does the Rambam say you can make a bracha on a pasul Sefer Torah, the Rambam says, if all you have is a single chumash, or if you don't have a chumash, if you know it baal peh and you don't have any sefer, the Rambam says you read Kriyas HaTorah and you make brachos. Now, some claim the Rambam must have retracted that because in the Mishnah Torah he paskins that one letter wrong passes a sefer Torah. The Baalei Tosfos disagreed, but that was the Rambam shita and many Rishonim shita. So. Some claim the Rambam changed his mind. And I think the Maribe Rav is quoted in Beis Yosef to say, of course the Rambam didn't change his mind. The mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah and the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah are two different mitzvahs. Kriyas HaTorah is Talmud Torah Barabim, and therefore you read the psukim. You're supposed to read from a text. You don't have a text? Okay, so you do it without a text, but you make brachos. But if it comes to writing Ksiva Sefer Torah, one missing letter passes the Sefer Torah. So the Shagas Aryeh says, we may write Sefer Torah because we're going to read from them, but at the end of the day, we can't really be Mekayim in the midst of Ksiva Sefer Torah because we know from the Gemara Kiddushin that we're not Bekiyim and Chaseros and Yeseros. We know from all of these things there are questions about the text. So the Shagas Aryeh says, We're not Yotzik Shiva Sefer Torah. Anyway, so therefore we have Svarim to learn from. But bottom line is, not everybody writes a Sefer Torah, because really you're not going to fulfill the mitzvah anyway. Others, the Minchas Chinuch, for example, that wouldn't solve all the problems, claims that not all, even according to the Rambam, not all psulim possible a Sefer Torah. But that was the Shagas Ari's response to be Melamed Tzchus and Klal Yisrael. But either way, I think it's very clear that there are many circumstances in which our text of the Masoretic text, that's what the term comes from, the Bali Masorah, differs in small detail from that which Chazal in the Gemara and various Midrashim had in front of them. The Rishonim, Chazal already, and the Rishonim were, and Achronim were aware of this particular issue, while the general psak of the Rishonim and the Achronim went in one direction, that you're supposed to change our Svarim to match that which the Gemara had. In fact, the Halacha L'maisa of Minog of Klal Yisrael, in fact, is not to do so.